Afternoon, everybody. Welcome. Nice to see a good audience here today. We chose this particular topic because of the recent visit of the Indian Prime Minister. We thought it was topical, and we hoped that we would generate an interesting and useful debate as we normally do on these occasions. And I'm very pleased to see all of you here. We have a panel of three that I will introduce in a moment, and then we are hoping that the Indian Deputy High Commissioner will come, and I will ask him to say a few words at the end to sort of bring everything together. But before I get on to that, just to announce the next business of the GSF. Our next event will take place in the room next to us, the smaller room, on Wednesday the 2nd of December. It's an afternoon seminar entitled The Hardy News Corps, the Online Battleground. And it will take place from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. and you can find full details on our website. For those of you who don't fully understand that particular title, we want to look at the way in which IS, in particular, is using the media and the dark web and so on in order to communicate and see whether we can find some ways of challenging them in a way that hasn't yet proved possible. The event is already very full, and priority for the remaining places will be given to contributing GSF members. If you'd like to attend, let Jackie and Jinx know on your way out. And I hope that she will try and do what she can to make sure we get you in. Now today we have, as I say, the title of our session is India's International Relations Under Prime Minister Modi, Non-Aligned or Realigned. Whether that is a relevant title, I'm not sure, we'll discover when we hear from our speaker, whether they think that my imaginative question is the right one or not. We have, first of all, one speaker who has sent his apologies, and that's Alok Sharma MP, who's co-chairman of the Conservative Friends of India. He was coming, but his father's in hospital and he sends his apologies, and I'm sure you would like me to send our best wishes to him and to his father as well. But we have a very erudite panel. I will introduce them in the order in which I'm going to ask them to speak. First of all, my father, John Dubber, who is the Head of Policy and External Relations at the British Council. He leads the Council's programme of corporate policy research and insight and the organisation's government and parliamentary relations. He's one of the authors of the British Council's recent India Matters report, and I'm sure he will have some interesting insights to give us today. Then on my left is Lance Price, who's a political strategy consultant. He worked in Downing Street from 1998 to 2000 when he was a deputy to someone called Alistair Campbell, who you may have heard of. He was the Labour Party's Director of Communications from 2000 until general election of 2001, when Tony Blair, as I remember to my cost, Conservative Party chairman, secured his second landslide. Before joining Number 10, he was a BBC political correspondent for many years. His books include, and I think the most recent, The Modi Effect, Inside Narendra Modi's Campaign to Transform India. And again, I think we'll get some very interesting insights from him as well. And then on my far right, we have Shashank Joshi, who is a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, in London. And many of you will have seen him frequently on television and heard him on the radio. And I again look forward to hearing what he has to say to us. He specialises in the international politics of South Asia and the Middle East, with a particular interest in Indian foreign and security policy. So, again, I think we have an excellent panel. As I say, we hope that the Deputy High Commissioner of India will appear, and if he does, I will stop the questions a little early in order to give him time to summarise at the very end. But I'm going to start by asking John Dubber if he'd like to talk to us.
So, thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. The British Council has been building friendship and understanding between the UK and India for nearly 70 years now, and we do this through programmes in culture, education, language, science, sport and civil society. And these make a difference in India, supporting development and prosperity, while also strengthening the UK's influence and increasing the potential for future trade and investment between the countries. Just to give you some sense of scale, each year in India we work with 500,000 people face-to-face and up to 45 million people through broadcasts, publications and online. Now, India's economic, cultural and geopolitical influence is growing very fast. It's already the third largest economy in the world and is predicted to become the second largest. India is forecast to overtake China as the world's most populous country and could soon have a larger working age population than China and the US combined. And the result is that India presents huge opportunities for UK trade and exports. Its growing number of middle class consumers offer an enormous new market for UK products and services. And as the Indian economy grows, so its political, military and cultural power is likely to undergo a similar transformation. As Jim O'Neill has written recently, India will soon become one of the biggest influences on the world. And in 2013, the German Marshall Fund, which is a US think tank, predicted that India was one of just four global powers that was likely to shape the entire future of the rules-based international system. And increasingly, the stances it takes on issues such as climate change, international security, will matter hugely for the whole planet. So India's foreign policy really matters for the UK and will matter even more in the decades to come. So the UK is home to the second largest Indian diaspora population in the world, and we've embraced a huge amount of Indian culture, food, fashion and music. India too has absorbed very significant influence from the UK. There are, for example, more readers of Dickens, Shakespeare and other leading UK authors in India than there are in Britain today. And the cultural connection between the two nations is a huge advantage for us compared to other countries. However, our shared cultural heritage of tea and cricket will not necessarily be sufficient to maintain a strong relationship in the future. And the victory of Modi in the 2014 elections has changed India's international outlook. The BJP's manifesto stated it is a desire to, and I quote, fundamentally reboot and reorientate foreign policy so that it leads to an economically stronger India and its voice is heard in international fora. And we can see that Modi's been extremely busy internationally, but London was the 29th foreign capital that he's visited. So that perhaps suggests that the UK isn't quite at the top of India's priority list in the world at the moment. And the truth of the matter is that we face increasing competition for India's attention. Modi's Look East policy has been widely publicised, and China is now India's biggest trading partner. In the cultural sector too, the French, the Germans, the Spanish, the Swiss, the Americans and the Koreans are all involved in actively growing their cultural collaboration with India. And young Indians are increasingly turning to the US, to Australia or to Germany for education and employment opportunities, with the number choosing to study in UK higher education falling by 49% in recent years. Now, the UK government has been actively responding to all of this. India was the first country that David Cameron visited as Prime Minister, and the Foreign Office's Network Shift programme has led to the opening of a whole load of new Deputy High Commissions and Trade Offices across India. And when I visited Delhi earlier this year and was in the High Commission, I was struck by the High Commissioner's ambitious strategy for the UK to be India's partner of choice across a whole range of strategically important areas. But even with all this activity, we can't be complacent. Last month, the British Council published some new research, which is called India Matters, and there are copies available at the back of the room, looking at the health of the UK's long-term relationship with India. And it found some big opportunities, but also some quite worrying trends. These included a lack of knowledge and understanding of contemporary India here in the UK. And we found that 74% of young educated Indians said they felt they knew a great deal or a fair amount about the UK. But worryingly, in contrast, just 21% of their peers from the UK said the same about India. And there was a similar mismatch in terms of the levels of direct experience between the two countries. The research also looked at the health of the cultural and educational relationship and the way that this can underpin future diplomatic and commercial ties. And we know from previous research by Ipsos Mori and YouGov that the level of trust between the people of India and the people of the UK is actually quite high. But that people who participate in a cultural or an educational relationship with the UK have a much higher level of trust than those who don't. And levels of trust were 19% higher amongst those who participate in cultural educational connections. The research also found that if you participate in those things and have a higher level of trust, you're going to be more likely to be interested in visiting the UK as a tourist, to studying in a UK university, or crucially, to doing business with UK companies. So culture and education can really underpin those broader ambitions that we have as a nation. So to help strengthen and renew the cultural relationship for the future, during Modi's recent visit, we were really pleased to announce that 2017 is going to be the UK-India Year of Culture. And we hope that this will enable many of the UK's leading arts and cultural institutions to develop new projects and performances in India, and a similar showcase of Indian culture here in the UK. Now, India's education system is also undergoing a dramatic transformation at the moment. Just to keep pace with demographic growth, over the next 20 years, India will have to embark on the biggest expansion of a higher education system in human history. It's forecast that India is going to have to open somewhere between 800 and 1,600 new universities just to keep pace with rising demand for higher education. 800 to 1,600 new universities. I mean, the numbers are just absolutely staggering. And the UK is very well positioned to provide the kinds of skills, the education infrastructure, the quality assurance to help India meet its aspirations. I mean, one example could be working to secure recognition of UK qualifications as part of India's National Skills and Qualifications Framework. This would help India achieve a workforce with highly prized global qualifications, while also delivering a big boost for the UK's influence in India, and could generate millions of pounds in export earnings for UK exam boards. And there are countless other education opportunities of that kind of scale. So the British Council is very pleased to have worked recently with our Indian partners to establish 2016 as the UK-India Year of Education, Research and Innovation. And we hope that this will help drive further collaboration between the sectors in both countries, including a range of digital technology-enabled education and training initiatives. So our India Matters report that I mentioned a few months ago has four main recommendations for how the opportunities that are latent in the UK-India relationship could be turned to advantage for both sides. And I'd like to finish by just summarising them. And they are, firstly, that the UK should be really ambitious about its relationship with India. It should have long-term programmes that are relevant to India's needs and ambitions, and they should be based on collaborative ways of working between the two countries. And perhaps most importantly, they should involve the next generation of young people who will be the leaders and influencers in both countries by the middle of the century. So that's the roadmap. I know that the energy and drive to make it happen is out there, and I think a lot of it's in this room today. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you especially to Michael, particularly generous of him, I think, given that, as he pointed out, I spent 3 years working for the Labour Party at the time when he held high office in the Tory Party, and basically my job was to ensure that his ambitions and those of his leader, William Hague, weren't realised during any of those 3 years, where I fear we had a degree of success that perhaps to this day he may regret. So it's extremely generous of him to invite me to come and speak here today. I should point out, of course, that during most of that time I was a special advisor, so I wasn't involved in any attacks on the opposition, but that's a different debate that we've been had many times and will, I'm sure, be had again. Also, great to be in the National Liberal Club. I don't know if anyone was watching London Spy on BBC Two last night, an excellent series of dramas. But there was a scene there which was set in a gentleman's club where women weren't permitted, although I see that a few have sneaked in today. It was filmed here. And also good to be in the David Lloyd George room talking about a man who is clearly has something in common with David Lloyd George. The oratorical skills that Modi possesses is one of the things that are remarked upon perhaps more than anything else. And in the way that David Lloyd George was referred to in his lifetime as the Welsh wizard, I think in some ways Narendra Modi is described as the Indian equivalent, an Indian wizard of types. I claim no great foreign policy expertise, although in my earlier career at the BBC I was briefly a foreign affairs and defence correspondent, so I suppose I ought to know something about it. But I think I'm here mainly because I wrote a book about Narendra Modi, and in particular Narendra Modi's election campaign back in 2014. And in the process of researching that book, I was very fortunate to spend 5 hours, a bit over 5 hours, with Narendra Modi himself, which I guess ought to give me some sort of insight into him as a man. All I can tell you coming away from that is I'm not sure I ever really got to know him as a man, but politicians are sometimes a bit like that, especially when they're in office. They're always on duty and they're continuing to do their job, promoting themselves, their party, their country and so on, and he was extremely good at that, and that of course is one of the bedrocks of his foreign policy, such as it is. But it's interesting that the subject of this debate, foreign policy, non-aligned or realigned, question mark. And I've done a number of debates here and in the States and in India and elsewhere since publishing the book, and they always have a question mark at the end. And there's a reason for that, which is that Narendra Modi is one of the most enigmatic world leaders that there is, and that people are constantly trying to put a finger on exactly what he's about, on all sorts of things. And he is, in many ways, although he never stops talking, it seems, he is deliberately vague about a whole range of matters that other people consider important, and he may very well consider important himself, but he deems it politic. Not to come down on one side or the other. And the question that we're debating today may well be one of those. During the course of all the interviews I did with him, which was after he was already Prime Minister, foreign affairs came up very rarely. He didn't seem particularly keen to talk about it. And I would suggest that despite the fact that, as John pointed out, he's visited 29, probably 30 or more. It's hard to keep track. He moves about so fast that it's hard to keep track of just how many countries he has visited. It must be. He went from Britain to Turkey, so he must have done at least 30, if not more, by now. That, curiously, I'm not sure that he is what we would think of as a foreign policy prime minister. I think his priorities are very much on the domestic front, and that is the prism through which we should view his foreign policy initiatives. But we do know that he's clocked up a few air miles since he's been Prime Minister. There was a joke, not a very good joke, that was circulating on social media in India of a little boy in school, and the teacher said to him, "What goes round the sun?" And the little boy said, "The earth." And then the teacher said, "And what goes around the earth?" And the little boy said, "Modi." Now, curiously, that started right from the very beginning of his premiership. We're familiar, I think, certainly in this country, with prime ministers who, when they sort of turn to foreign affairs, when they realise that domestic policy is a bit more tricky than they thought it was going to be, and they're making less progress than they were hoping to make, and they suddenly discover that strutting about on the world stage is actually rather good fun, and you can appear to be doing things, and you can appear to be clocking up some successes and getting some good headlines. Modi, on the other hand, did it right from the word go. I mean, he got onto his first plane within days of becoming Prime Minister, and he hasn't stopped since. And he's obviously taking a political risk in doing so, because over the past 18 months or so since he's been Prime Minister, the going has already got pretty tough domestically. He's had a lot of problems at home. He raised expectations to remarkable heights during that extraordinary election campaign that he fought across India over a period of almost 6 months of campaigning. And it is proving very difficult to actually deliver on much that he promised to do. So he leaves himself open to the charge of not being at home, concentrating on the issues that really matter to the people of India, and spending far too much of his time meeting heads of state around the world. Now, I think I'd like to make the contention that he's not, as I say, a foreign policy prime minister, and that he doesn't have a particularly significant interest in the strategic side of foreign policy. Or if he does, he's keeping it to himself, and that's why we have a question mark at the end of the debate that we've got today, and why people still wonder exactly what makes him tick. John referred to the BJP manifesto for the elections in 2014. But actually, the words he quoted were just about all that there was in there. It's a long document, and there's very, very little on foreign affairs. Modi doesn't have a background in foreign affairs. As Chief Minister of Gujarat, he was a domestic politician, concentrated very much on issues related to his state. And insofar as the outside world mattered to him, which it did, It was about attracting foreign investors and signing big deals for inward investment into his state, for which he claimed a great deal of success in the election campaign and promised to replicate on an India-wide scale thereafter. Now, his political opponents would, with some justice, claim that there was a bit of hype about all that, a bit of, dare I say it, as a former spin doctor, a bit of spin about all that. A lot of the headlines talked about memoranda of understanding that were signed, as they have done since Modi has been travelling the world. And yet, figures that I've seen suggest that maybe 5% of the amount of money that's promised in those memoranda of understanding ever actually gets delivered and turns into real contracts and real investment in the country. But that was pretty much all he knew about, or appeared to know about, foreign affairs, or interest that he showed in foreign affairs before becoming Prime Minister. So I think what he's doing now, I mean, obviously it's important to him, or he wouldn't be doing all this travel. What he's doing is trying to be a brand ambassador for India, and at that he's incredibly successful, because we know that he's a great orator. We know that he's good at grabbing the headlines. He's good at turning a phrase, even in English, which is only his third language. He comes up with these sometimes rather annoying alliterative slogans for every policy that he wants to announce or initiative that he wants to get going with. But he's extraordinarily good at that. He's good at going out and saying to the world, India is on a different path. India is changing. I symbolise that change. Look at me, take an interest in me, because I want you to take an interest in India, and not only that, I want you to invest in India, and I want you to help us with the growth plans that we have, and the huge task that we face across the board, which can only be done with the help of the outside world. And the latest conversation I had with him, after the book came out, I asked him about how the foreign travel was going, why he was doing it, and he was pretty blunt about it. It was simply to get the money that he doesn't have himself to invest in the things that he needs to do, which is why the kind of announcements that we had ahead of his visit here to London were significant. Rupee bonds on the London Stock Exchange, opening up areas of the Indian economy to foreign direct investment that weren't available before, some very important things for him. Now, again, headline grabbing, whether they translate into reality is something that it's going to take a bit longer still to judge. And the worry is, one American commentator said he was all sizzle and no steak, which, given the domestic sensitivity of it, is probably a slightly more polite way of asking the traditional question, where's the beef? Now, where's the beef as a domestic political issue is a completely different debate that we won't get into now. But you know, is there any beef? Is there any steak or sausage behind all the sizzle? And if you look at some of the initiatives that he's tried to do in his foreign policy, looking east, his first announcement was that he wanted his foreign policy to be neighbours first. And neighbours first meant a flurry of visits to the countries that are his neighbours. All went very well, lots of slapping on the back. He took the courageous and, for a Hindu nationalist, perhaps unexpected decision to invite the Pakistani Prime Minister to his swearing-in ceremony, which was accepted. And he went straight off to Nepal and Sri Lanka and to Bhutan and to Myanmar and other countries to try to build this neighbourhood-first policy. A policy which has fairly quickly, it has to be said, run into the sands, or at least run into considerable difficulty. If he was holding out the prospect of better relations with Pakistan, it didn't last for very long. He very quickly called off bilateral meetings at official level, and there's been a war of words at the United Nations, and the usual tension between the two countries appears to be the order of the day once again. So very little change from the foreign policy of the outgoing government of Manmohan Singh, Congress-led UPA government, with Nepal, where the Nepalese responded very, very positively, another Hindu-majority country, very positively to his visit and everything that he had to say. Then, when it came to Nepal rewriting their constitution, India turned into the bully boy neighbour who tried to tell them what they should have in it, even after they'd written it, published it, and had it passed by a considerable majority, a very large majority in their own constituent assembly, and that didn't go down at all well. So the neighbourhood first policy doesn't seem to be bearing a lot of fruit on either side at this stage. Then, of course, reaching out to the West, which is crucially important for his domestic economic interests. And that has been, you know, it's been a barnstorming, literally barnstorming performance with these phenomenal bits of oratory in Madison Square Gardens and in Sydney and Melbourne and now in London. But still a big question mark over what he really is as a prime minister, which goes back to his the enigma around his domestic policy and whether he really is a Hindu nationalist. And it's not without significance that President Obama, even in New Delhi, didn't quite lecture him. You're more diplomatic than that when you're a president and visited somebody else's capital, but made it clear that any move towards religious intolerance, which many people feel is going on in India, was not going to be productive in terms of relationships with the West or anywhere else. So he wants India to be a leading power rather than a balancing power, and that would indicate that it is realignment rather than non-alignment that he's interested in. But if it is going to be a realignment, we don't know which direction he's heading in. And so I would just leave with the suggestion I opened with, that perhaps there isn't really a foreign policy, there isn't a strategy, unless it's a devilishly well-hidden strategy. And I think if there was a clear strategy of leadership, we would know what it was. Clearly we don't, otherwise there wouldn't be a question mark at the end of the issue that we're debating.
Good afternoon, everyone. Very nice to see you all. Lance has already summarised a great deal of what I was going to say, but I thought I'd pick up from that comment he made about Prime Minister Modi being an enigma. It's a very interesting place to start. And I think the enigmatic quality about Modi, the polarising quality about him, for reasons that are quite obvious, even the cult of Modi, for which one sees among some of his acolytes, I think all of these obscure great deal of Indian foreign policy. I disagree slightly with Lawrence, and I do think there is a strategy to a great deal of what he does. I just think it's an inherited and adaptive strategy from previous governments, including from the UPA2, the coalition Congress-led government that preceded him. In many respects, I think what he does in Asia, what he does with the United States, even on big global issues, a great deal of this is adapted. It's tweaked, and it's all overlaid with the glitz and glamour of Modi in a way that was, of course, entirely lacking with Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who was in some ways a very different sort of figure generationally, politically, and even in his own style. If we had this talk a year ago, I think we'd all have been fating Modi, and Lance summarised some of the reasons why. It was the invitation to the SAARC countries, the South Asian Association of Regional Cooperation Countries, to his inauguration. It was the invite to Nawaz Sharif in particular. It was the intense, active, focused diplomacy on what were some hitherto neglected areas, including some of the Indian Ocean territories, to Nepal twice, where he generated absolutely enormous goodwill and was able to harness some of those BJP networks, Hindu nationalist networks, inside Nepal in a way that the Congress Party perhaps hadn't been able to do to the same degree. And I think we were the allure of Modi's high profile, the sense to which he himself and his supporters claimed he was radically refashioning Indian foreign policy, bringing back pride after sort of eight wasted, multiple wasted years, a sense of purpose, a sense of drive. These were raising expectations both domestically and internationally. And I think some of those expectations have been met, and I will talk about a few of the successes in a moment, but I think it's also worth talking about a few of the failures, where perhaps that hasn't occurred. And I'll be repeating Lance a little bit, so just bear with me. I think Nepal's a very interesting example, because if you speak to many of those on, for example, within India's press, and the foreign correspondents, those on the diplomatic beat, those who have covered this area for a long time, I think there's an enormous sense of frustration, of irritation, of anger at the way the Indian establishment has handled the Nepal issue, in particular eroding, frittering away some of the goodwill that Modi earned. Of course, there's the issue of the alleged blockade, or India's role in facilitating the blockade of Nepal. There's the issue of constitutional interference. There's the issue of ethnic intervention in ethnic politics. All of this is, of course, very heavily contested, but that's certainly the perception. I think the interesting long-term question, I mean, India's had ups and downs with its neighbours in the past. This is not new. It's had blockades of Nepal before. It's had a breakdown in relations with the Nepali authorities. It's had the same with Bangladesh, the same with Bhutan, the same with Sri Lanka. This is completely normal. I think the issue is this comes with the backdrop of growing Chinese influence in South Asia. And the question is, does this open opportunities for China to consolidate some of the diplomatic gains it's made in previous years? So, for example, a few weeks ago, we saw a major oil deal signed between Nepal and a Chinese state-owned oil company, which effectively broke what was a near monopoly for 40 years by Indian companies. So it's another example that follows on previous cases that precede Modi of China making important inroads in countries, in areas that India previously considered relatively contained within its strategic backyard and quite safe. I won't say too much on Pakistan. Lance already talked about the calling off of talks between the national security advisers over the issue of whether Pakistan's national security adviser could or could not meet Kashmiri separatists while he was in India, along with Pakistani efforts to broaden the agenda of those talks beyond that which was previously agreed. It also built on a terrorist attack in Gurdaspur in July, which India blamed on Pakistan, and I think a sense that issues like violent incidents in Kashmir, attacks, infiltration across the line of control has been steadily ticking up, and that's been a matter of state policy by Pakistan. I think there's no serious prospect of a resumption in serious dialogue in the short to medium term. Again, nothing new here. Oscillation between intense engagement, high hopes, a collapse of dialogue. This is a quite regular pattern for Indian foreign policy towards Pakistan in ways I think we're all familiar with. And there are some other sort of less known examples, I think, that are also interesting. The Maldives is quite an interesting example. India's been concerned for a long time by escalating Chinese involvement in the Maldives, economic investments, strategic investment, facilities, infrastructure at the expense of Indian companies. And of course, there's been a long period in which changes of government within the Maldives have been seen by India as threatening to its interests. The role of Islamists on the island is concerning, the state of emergency that was declared a few weeks ago, and there's in a way that sort of potentially sidelines pro-India politicians. And Indians, you know, have taken a very cautious approach to this. They haven't made very loud statements. They haven't intervened very heavily. They certainly haven't sort of been very heavy-handed about it. But I think we're again seeing a continual process of challenge all along India's land and maritime periphery from China, from other countries, and India coming to terms with that and trying to find the right way to respond to its smaller neighbours, securing its interests without provoking a backlash, and not always getting that balance entirely right. Now, and I should also say, of course, one thing I don't think we touched on a great deal is in the domestic context, of course, Modi's crushing defeat in the Bihar elections isn't directly related to foreign policy, of course, but it does impact the local political environment in which he has to make decisions. It comes on top of the fact that he's not going to gain control of the upper house that limits his hand with particular legislation. And these things can, in certain ways, trickle out to foreign policy in sort of slight indirect and subtle ways. Not that that affected his UK visit. There was no shadow of Bihar that was cast on this. Just a few notes on some of the very quick on some of the bright spots. First of all, I think many of us missed may not have picked up on a crucial agreement with Bangladesh in July, swapping 160 enclaves involving 50,000 people. Absolutely a critical piece of foreign policy, very, very significant. Sri Lanka, India, I think, is very happy that Rajapaksa is gone, regaining influence. It's widely believed, and quite credibly so, that Indian intelligence helped in giving him the boot. And I think also in terms of the United States, building very, very strongly on the US-India relationship, bringing Japan into the Malabar exercises, and in fact permanently extending an invite on that. And then, of course, there are some grey areas, big structural global issues. India's undecided on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, worried about being cut out. On climate change, where it's concerned about US-China collusion over its head. Nuclear export control regimes, where its entry into the MTCRR, the Missile Technology Control Regime, was blocked by Italy over a bilateral spat. And Afghanistan, where it's slowly feeling out Ghani after watching his rapprochement with Pakistan collapse. So, to sum up the title, alignment or non-alignment, I still have no doubt that we're seeing an erosion of non-alignment in terms of the relationship with the United States in security terms. And anyone who saw the joint statement, the joint vision for Asia-Pacific, India's willingness to mention the South China Sea, these are all things that were not on the cards 20 years ago. These are major developments. But on those big structural issues, climate change, trade, international financial institutions, and even some regional security issues. Middle East, of course, Syria, Afghanistan. There is still a strong, strong element of hedging that I think Modi inherited from his predecessors and will continue for the rest of his term as well. Thank you.
Now we've got time for a few comments and questions. I'm going to ask you if you signal that you want to intervene. Can you stand up and introduce yourself and face sideways so people at the back can hear your question? Michael Binion.
Michael Binion, The Times. I wonder if I could just follow up on the question of cultural relations, and in particular the heart issue of language, namely English language, and to ask whether there is still a basis for Britain and India to have a kind of special thing with English being medium of instruction, or whether India is now so confident that it is itself one of the largest English-speaking nations in the world and has taken possession of the language, which effectively cuts out British influence in that area. And the other point on educational exchanges is not the greatest single problem on this Britain's extremely restrictive attitude to visas for India.
Just on the issue of language, I mean, yes, of course, there are far more speakers of English in India than there are in the UK, but that does not mean that India isn't interested in UK expertise around the English language. So one example of that is something called Project English, run by the British Council, where we go and train the best teacher trainers so that they can cascade out to school, the public education system across India. So we've been working with a number of state governments across India to try and improve the quality of English language teaching, benefiting up to 17 million young Indians over the past few years. And we're seeing very high levels of demand for our teaching centres across India as well. So I think there is a significant role that the UK can play. On the point about education exchanges, I think it's very easy to kind of put the decline in Indian students entirely down to the visa situation. It is slightly more complicated than that. In that with some research specifically looking at this issue, we found there was a major barrier of cost associated with studying in the UK as well. The Indian government has recently capped the available student loans that are available for its students to take international study placements. The UK is one of the most expensive countries to study around the world. And also, the new visa restrictions prevent students from working during term time. So therefore, it makes it very difficult for students to come. But it's one of the things around the visa regime. So I think we've thought about this issue a lot over the past few years. And the other part of the visa regime that can be problematic is the issue of post-study work. And we've consistently said that we think that there should be a review of that to look at whether or not some options for post-study work should be available, and indeed whether students should in fact be part of the net migration figures at all, or whether they should be counted separately.
Thank you.
downplay English, and in fact replace it wherever possible with Hindi as part of his strategy of national self-confidence, national pride, and all the rest of it. Interestingly, Gujarat, which develops very fast in many other parts of India, well, it didn't develop that, despite Modi's personal passion for IT and the internet and everything else, it didn't develop as an IT hub. And one of the reasons that I think more to Bangalore than to Gujarat was that English is not taught in Gujarat schools as much as it is elsewhere in India. And there have been signs since Modi's election that the education department wants to pursue a policy of downgrading English in Indian schools in favour of Indian languages.
Lord Hilton has the Lords. I've only once visited India and Pakistan, and India was a long time ago, so I claim no special expertise. But do the panel consider that there will, within reasonable time, be a detente between India and Pakistan? The lack of that is symbolised by their long frontier, with only, I believe, one official crossing point. Could the Commonwealth help to do something to promote at least economic detente?
Sure, yeah, no problem. So a rather depressing answer, I'm afraid, I think it's no. And I think the core reason for that is that Pakistan's relationship with its reliance on particular non-state armed groups like the terrorist group Lashkar-e Taiba is so deep-seated as a part of its strategic culture. The military's control over foreign policy and security policy in Pakistan is so entrenched and so firm. But I don't see the circumstances under which those two twin transitions in terms of a serious transition from military control to civilian control and a change in attitudes towards groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba would be seriously affected. In terms of economic ties, of course, there were over the last few years some efforts to do this. The Pakistani civilian Salim government was quite open to some of these ideas, particularly granting the so-called most favoured nation status to India. We saw the Pakistani military authorities effectively veto this. And lastly, I think on the Indian side, there's really no sense of pressing need to make serious concessions to the extent that they could. I think they feel time is on their side. That Pakistan's ability to use military coercion to change the status quo is beyond their ability. That they failed to do so during Kargil, and therefore I'm rather a sort of sceptic and pessimist on this, I'm afraid. Sorry.
I think no as well, for all the reasons that we've just heard, many of which are perfectly good reasons. I think there's also this slight worry that Modi would use his domestic political interests to pursue a policy of detente in his efforts to consolidate the Hindu vote behind the BJP.
We'll call two next time, so we can try and get some more in, first of all.
Shireen Akina, University of London. I think the question was very interesting. Non-aligned, realigned, both of those terms imply a hinterland, a close hinterland and a distant hinterland. My area of interest and specialisation is Central Asia. And what I see is not so much aligned or non-aligned or realigned, but consistency. And in Indian policy up to now, what one has seen is a lack of consistency or consistent effort. There have been an attempt to engage with Central Asian states, way back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it's only now really that it's being taken seriously. And an important marker was, of course, India's entry into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a full member. And what that signals is not just engagement with Central Asia, but with Eurasia, with Russia, another full member, and with Iran, an observer member. And I think both those countries, Iran and Russia, are becoming extremely important to India, not least because of the Afghan question, which was mentioned by the third speaker, Port of Chabahar. Incredibly important for India in relation to what's happening in Afghanistan, which I believe someone else with more time to enlarge upon if they wish. But it's a lack of consistency, and it's also its sphere of interest. And to me, what I see is in your actually engaging with Eurasia very strongly. But I'd be very interested to hear what the panel thinks.
Michael Arthur, former High Commissioner in India. Two very quick questions. One to John. You spot on in the three reasons for how you can improve the situation on visas, let them work, and take up the immigration figures. What can we do outside government to help you win that battle inside government? My main question to Shashank. You talked a bit about the liberalisation of the FDI and one or other areas of power, and how the domestic economy was the real driver of a lot of foreign activities that keeps up. I spent the weekend, rather alarmingly, with some very senior trade policy ministers, transatlantic people doing TPP, TTIP, and all that. And they are so fed up, that community, with Indian blockage on trade policy issues, that the move there, and I kid you not, was let them stew, they want to protect themselves and spiral downwards. We will just move on in multilateral and other areas. What prospect for a step change in India's engagement in the trade, the sort of widening up agenda?
Sure. I mean, on Central Asia, I think it's you're alluding to Modi's trip to Central Asia, he went to Mongolia, and obviously interested in Mongolian uranium. He was in Tajikistan, where India has in the past helped refurbish particular military-related facilities. And there's certainly an effort there also with Iran. After the deal, I think India certainly saw an opportunity to make up some of the lost ground that was impeded by sanctions. However, I think there's two caveats here. One of them is I still see some very weak links. One of them is connectivity. You mentioned Chabahar, the Iranian port in which India has invested and envisages as one means by which it can circumvent Pakistan, which of course is a giant geographical obstacle to its access to Afghanistan and beyond. I mean, as far as I can see from the outside, Chabahar has proceeded at a snail's pace with very little sense that it's to be treated as a strategic project. And so that's one of the reasons why connectivity is still a major issue. The second aspect is, with Russia, I think Russia's in rather an interesting position in South Asia right now. On the one hand, the Indian Defence Minister was in Moscow just a couple of weeks ago, and they seem to have agreed to purchase Russia's most advanced air defence system, the S-400, and there's obviously all sorts of other projects. But Russia's also making almost unprecedented outreach to Pakistan in the last sort of 6 months or so. Talk of selling attack helicopters, potentially selling other military equipment, I'm not sure sort of how, and of course naval exercises as well announced I think this week. So I think India is also trying to ask itself where Russian policy is going and how that can be managed in Central Asia, because of course India's freedom of manoeuvre in places like Tajikistan depends a great deal on Russian acquiescence, just for basic reasons, including, as you know very well, Russian control of civil airspace, for example. On your question, Michael, I don't follow multilateral trade policy at all, so I can't answer that. It's a great question. Certainly, I've also picked up similar mood here, and I've seen it's interesting to watch how India has responded to TPP very, very cautiously. I think it's watching where China goes, and China's obviously also responded in a sort of slightly schizophrenic way, welcoming it initially and then insisting that it's a fragmentary, you know, balkanizing sort of trade agreement. But I honestly don't know where Indian attitudes towards multilateral talks are. It's something I have followed very closely. On FDI, though, I do think this is one of those areas where the incredibly high expectations set by Modi as some sort of would-be Thatcherite planning for an Indian big bang was sorely, sorely disappointed. And on FDI, the announcements made 2 weeks ago were quite disappointing. I think they were quite a bit of sophistry there in terms of what they actually entailed. And I think in terms of many of the fundamental issues, the predictability of the business environment, retrospective taxation, of course, being a major UK-India bugbear, I don't see an awful lot of progress on those.
Just on the issue of visas, I think one of the things we've noticed is that the debate about visas tends to be very emotive, and actually what can happen with that is you get some quite strong statements made by the UK politicians or the UK media, and those things are picked up in and reported back, and that can make the situation actually worse than it was in the first place. So it's not just the substance that's the problem, it's also the perception that's very significant as well. So in terms of things that people can do to help, I guess the
in the UK? How important, for example, is it trade as compared with competitor countries which have the limited diaspora, be it Germany, France, Switzerland, or whatever, in terms of culture? Are we seeking to use the Indian diaspora to go to Indian universities for their own sake, and for the quality of language? And more particularly in foreign affairs, my impression is, as a former constituency MP for 35 years, that the Pakistani diaspora is very involved in terms of pressure, particularly of Kashmir, whereas the Indian diaspora is pretty quiescent in terms of seeking to bring pressure on foreign affairs. Does the panel agree with this?
The Indian diaspora is very important on both sides. I mean, very important to Modi because they give him a lot of support. He's got financial support. A lot of money flows from the Indian diaspora back into India and is crucial to the Indian economy. They also give him a lot of political support. A lot of people from the Indian diaspora were there for the campaign, to help you with the campaign, and their crucial bit of his political support. I think in terms of our British domestic politics, the Indian diaspora are very interesting, and it was fascinating to see David Cameron at Wembley as the sort of warm-up act for Modi before us. A curious position for a prime minister in his own country to be, but one I think he was very, very happy to do. Because if you look at the results of the last general election, the Hindu vote, I think for the first time, more Hindus voted Conservative than voted Labour. And for me, as a Labour Party man, that whole visit was just a series of PR disasters in terms of the Labour Party's relationship with the community in this country. I'm not sure I agree that they're quiescent. I think they are seeking to exercise their influence. They may be slightly more good-mannered about it, but they want to have their voice heard in domestic politics. In the Labour Party, I think they're very frustrated and unloved, and I think that's a shame. I think in the Conservative Party, there are a lot of people very, very willing to listen to them because they recognise the importance and the value of that vote block.
Yeah, it's nothing substantial, but just often the fact that I'm mildly amused by the fact that Modi has come and addressed 50,000 members of the diaspora, and yet India's shutting down and kicking out groups like Greenpeace because of alleged foreign funding and failure to disclose paperwork like that.
Yes, can I just come in briefly? I mean, the extent of the trade relationship between the two countries is actually incredibly strong. I'm sure that the diaspora plays a major role in that. And the top 41 Indian companies in the UK turn over £19 billion. So there are many thousands of UK jobs that are supported by the Indian diaspora. And the UK's got more money invested in India than any other country. UK banks lend more to India than any other country. So, the relationship is quite strong. However, it is declining. So in 1999, UK was the fourth largest source of imports to India, and in 2015 it's the 18th. So our relative position is declining, and those links that the diaspora provides to us won't necessarily help us so much in the future. I think the bigger issue actually is the extent to which knowledge of contemporary India is shared more widely within UK society, and whether the future leaders and influencers in the UK are getting sufficient opportunities to understand contemporary India and experience contemporary India. Are there sufficient UK students going out and studying for their degrees in India? I think the current number of UK students studying for their full-time degree in India is 80. Just 80. So the numbers are very, very important. So I think anything we can do to promote that exchange between the people who will be the leaders of our countries when India is one of the greatest global powers would be very important.
And people go to the seaside universities teaching English?
Oh, well, sorry, I mean,
improving the quality of English.
Yes, I think anything there are opportunities to get involved in the teaching of English, but also studying for other subjects. Or we've just signed an agreement with Tata Consultancy Services to enable 1,000 young British people to go and undertake internships in the Indian IT sector for a year. So there are lots and lots of different opportunities where UK young people can go and spend time in India. We just need to encourage them to seek them out.
Thank you. We have been joined by the Deputy High Commissioner of India in London, Miranda Paul, and I'm now going to ask him if he would like to, I'm not quite sure, respond, summarise, disagree. The floor is yours.
To begin with, I would like to thank you for inviting me
challenged by poverty, hunger, disease, sickness. A country of 1.25 billion people, half of them below the age of 35 years. And to achieve this rapid economic development and rapid modernization, what we need peaceful periphery. And when I talk about peaceful periphery, I talk about our desire to have the best of relations with our immediate neighborhood. Some of the countries were mentioned in the previous presentations, so peaceful periphery are good relations with the East, you know, the Look East policy, the Look, the Act East policy, and relations with the West, the great powers, and the role of India on global issues, whether it's the international financial situation, international terrorism, climate change, and the rest of it. So how the government is striving to achieve the goals that it has set for itself for development and modernization. You might have heard of new expressions like Make in India, Digital India, Scale India, large-scale expansion of India's infrastructure, smart cities, new industrial corridors. There is a tendency in some circles to describe these initiatives as slogans, but I would like to clarify that, you know, it's not just slogans. These are campaigns of the present government. And there's also a tendency in some circles to question the results or the pace of results. So here I would like to say that if you look at the economic initiatives, the figures that are available now from October 2014 to October 2015, there has been an increase of 48% in FDI into India. The economy is growing. The outlook is 7.5%, perhaps a little higher. India happens to be the fastest growing major economy, and as we seek to transform India in a big way and rapidly, certainly there is a role of India's external engagement. Role of diaspora. Now, diaspora in the India-UK context, I think, is a very important pillar of strength. 1.5 million people are of Indian origin in this country. There are 325,000 people living in this country who are Indian Indians, basically Indians who hold Indian passports. And last year I saw an early day motion moved by one Indian origin parliamentarian, and it said that Indians constitute 1.2% of the country's population, but contribute over 6% of the GDP. So this, in a way, reflects the contribution of the Indian diaspora to the British society, to the British economy, and at the same time, we believe that Indian origin people in this country, law-abiding, hard-working, peace-loving people, they have an instinctive admiration for India. You know, they are the best ambassadors to let others know what India stands about, what India is all about, and what India stands for. So we celebrate their contribution in this country, and I think they are an important bridge as we. And this was very visible when our Prime Minister was here a few days ago, and we have 60,000 people, and I don't think any other political leader globally has attracted that enough in terms of size of the diaspora. Shashank mentioned about Nepal. Here I would like to clarify that there is no blockage. There is no blockage by India. The political situation in Nepal, it is their internal political situation, largely caused by a certain disaffected section of the Nepalese population, and we hope that sooner than later a peaceful solution is found. Pakistan, understandably, figured repeatedly during the conversation, and here I would like
Mr. Modi invited all leaders of the countries in our immediate neighborhood. They had bilateral meetings, including with the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and more recently, a few months ago, the two Prime Ministers, the Indian Prime Minister and the Pakistani Prime Minister, they had a meeting in Ufa, in Russia, on the side of a multilateral meeting. And the idea was that we should move forward, because there had been talk about fourth century level talks, and talks were called off, and the reasons were very clear, because as far as India is concerned, when we deal with outstanding issues between India and Pakistan, one thing that is very, very clear is that there is no role for any third party intervention or any third party mediation in India-Pakistan conversations. But there was an attempt to do exactly the opposite of what we had wanted, and for that reason the talks were called off. And more recently, post-UFA, the understandings again were not observed in spirit, and these situations, you know, when India is moving forward, we stretch a helping hand. But from the other side, if such a sentiment is not reciprocated, it's generally not helpful. I would also like to touch upon terrorism. Terrorism in our immediate neighborhood and globally, I would not like to, you know, go into detail where the epicenter of terrorism is, but there have been a tendency by Pakistan to blame others. Now, it's not uncommon for states, when they are confronted with serious challenges, to blame others. But terrorism as an instrument of state policy is something that's not going to help. Terrorism in India, or in our neighborhood, or anywhere else in the world. So with these comments, I would like to thank you once again.
Thank you very much for a very comprehensive response. I think you covered all the areas. And I think we've had an interesting session. I'm not sure we had an answer to my question, but possibly that's because there isn't an answer. Things are moving, but nobody's quite certain in which direction. And maybe that is a reflection of our own policy, but I think it says so as well. Can I ask you to thank our panelists?
You're not going, but you'll be in charge. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to have to rush. You gave me a card before, but if you've got a card.